Hey everyone, Alex here. Hey, listen, we have a new series starting on the New Stack Makers. It's called the Tech Founder Odyssey. It's about technical founders, those people who are engineers who are starting their own companies. We've had the best feedback from people already on Twitter. The questions are awesome, and it's really going to be guiding us as we develop this series. We want to know about these people, why they got started, what motivated them, what were the lessons that they learned along the way. What is it that they've learned about themselves, about their backgrounds, about the people who they've hired to work with them? How have they grown this venture into something that will last? It's a big deal for these people. And I think it's a big deal for a lot of us who've thought about doing these kinds of things and are part of the companies that these engineers have started. We hope you enjoy it. Again, it's the Tech Founder Odyssey on the New Stack Makers. You're listening to the New Stack Makers, a podcast made for people who develop, deploy, and manage at-scale software. For more conversations and articles, go to thenewstack.io. All right, now on with the show. Okay, here today with Jake Warner, founder of Cycle. First in our founder series, we're going to interview founders who have a technical background. And seeing that we're talking about technical backgrounds, Jake, I interviewed somebody once who was a technical founder and they got their first computer out of a dumpster. Are you going to be the second person did I interview who got their first computer out of a dumpster?
No. The first computer I got, let's see, it was 1999. My grandfather, he had a Windows 95 machine and he was upgrading to a Windows 98 machine. And so I inherited his Windows 95 machine. And so that's where it all started.
So you started on Windows. What did you start programming? And did you start programming after you found all the games on the computer? Or tell me about that story about getting that Windows 95 machine.
So when I received that first machine, computers had always kind of interested me at that point, but that was really my kind of first experience into them. Any video games I had played at that time were on, I think it was like the Nintendo 64 or something at that time, right? So I wasn't really ever too much of a gamer. But it was around, I'd say probably 2001, 2002, where I was introduced to a video game called StarCraft. And that was the first game that I started playing where, to me, it was actually less of the game and more of the fact that it had chat rooms. Like, you know, there's a lot of people, their first introduction to chat rooms were AOL and things like that. For me, it was StarCraft. I'd log into the game, not to play the game, but to chat with people. And throughout that process of being in those chat rooms and talking with people, there was one time where, let's see, that was 2001, 2002. I would have been 10, 11 at the time. So this was Windows XP at the time. And someone had sent me, you know, a file and I had opened it. Like, I wasn't security conscious at the time. And, you know, ended up being a virus. And, I had to apologize to my dad for needing to do a full reinstall on the family computer. But it was the fact that someone, through just the use of a file, could cause that much damage that started making me like wonder, like, wow, there's a lot more to this than I thought. And it's kind of a weird introduction, but that was the initial start of it. One of the things that came of that was within this game, you used a network called Battle.net. by Blizzard, right, as a way of communicating. But there was groups of people on Battle.net who would, the same thing as me, they'd be logging in, but not to play the game, but they would be, it was almost groups of, you know, developers and engineers, things like that, that would figure out how to attack each other, right? So it's almost like we logged into a game to play a different game. So because of that, that got me interested in all of the kind of firewalls and security things, which led to getting into programming. And so to get back to your question, it started with a game, but very quickly went from a lot more than that.
Gosh, you know, that's a different take. It's like going to play basketball or the skate park and just chilling with your friends, really.
It was.
Same kind of thing, yeah.
It was different. And it's kind of weird because a lot of the people that I met back then, you know, my family had a rule. I mean, I was, again, 10 or 11, right? My parents had a rule that I couldn't tell anyone how old I was, right? So, you know, for years, I was just hanging out with all these people. No one had any idea how old I was. And now fast forward to now, what, 20, 21 years later, and I'm still friends with a lot of those people. They now know how old I am. And, you know, they're 8, 9 years older than I am. But it's interesting because so many of them are still doing like really technical things now. And we all kind of had that same weird beginning of, you know, just being in these chat rooms, trying to attack people in other chat rooms. Of course, you know, me being a 10-year-old, it was never like any necessarily, we were doing it for fun. We weren't doing it for reasons of trying to cause damage. It was a game between us. It was interesting.
How has that influenced you today? You're now the founder of Cycle. Tell us a little bit about Cycle and tell us about what you learned since then that led you to where you are.
So Cycle is we used to refer to it as a container orchestration platform. Recently, thanks to a number of conversations with people in the space, including people like Darren Shepard, many people watching this podcast probably are familiar with from Rancher. But we used to call Cycle a container orchestration platform until we've had a number of these people come back and say, like, Cycle does so much more. Like, you manage infrastructure, there's load balancing built into it. There's all these things beyond just containers. If you call Cycle a container orchestration platform, you're diluting some of the real value that Cycle can provide, right? So now we have started to transition into calling Cycle a low ops platform for building platforms. It's new messaging that we're experimenting with, and I can break it down a little. So the low ops part obviously is you shouldn't need to be like a super talented DevOps engineer with all this experience of different cloud infrastructures and deployment paradigms and things like that to be able to use Cycle. Whether you are an experienced DevOps engineer or whether you're a developer that might be deploying a server for the first time, Cycle should be able to fit what you're needing to do for both. But the second part of that, where we say platform for building platforms, is something that we've really started to stumble on recently. Most of the products and services and things like that being built on top of Cycle these days are platforms. And when I say a platform, I'm not necessarily saying like, oh, it's another container platform or a DevOps platform. It can be like a fintech platform or a real estate platform. But the word platform, it's kind of a generic word these days within the industry, but the word platform kind of implies a certain level of sophistication to it, right? And so when we say platform for building platforms, we're talking about companies that are building these services and products that have many moving pieces. There's front ends, back ends, APIs. There's a whole bunch of different components that make up those offerings. And we found that that's really where Cycle shines. So that's what Cycle is. It's a platform for building platforms. The idea is that you upload any OCI container, whether it was built with Docker or any of the other container technologies. As you upload those containers, you can choose what servers you want to run them on. So you can choose which provider, if you want bare metal, if you want virtual machines. The idea is that Cycle is giving users the convenience of a pass, but on their own infrastructure, focused around containers. So we're still trying to figure out the fully proper definition there.
This leads me to some questions, because yep. I think one thing we're trying to get to in this series is, what is it like to be a founder? And what are kind of these experiences that you go through, and how does it affect how you change your vision? I can speak from a founder myself, because I'm a founder of a tech media company. And what you talk about kind of relates back to things that I can recall in our earlier days, where we were talking about, well, what part of the stack do we really want to cover, right? Do we want to cover the front end? Do we want to cover the back end? So we focus on the back end architectures, because that was just a much more kind of finite place where we could focus. And it related to container architectures. There was just lots more there that we felt comfortable with and covering as well. The whole front end space is pretty vast, right? And so we're now moving into that space where we're focusing more on front end to some extent, but it relates to the back end through the full stack. So you had this idea initially as container and orchestration platform. What did you learn as you kind of started building it out? And then deciding to change your messaging, and how did it affect your perspectives? How did it affect the work that your engineering team did? How did it affect kind of your relationship with other people on the team? Because these are all the things that founders go through. They have to think about all those different parties.
there's a number of different ways to answer that. I think the biggest thing that makes me who I am as a technical founder is I like to place long-term bets. I don't want to generalize too much, but I think that we've, through the ways that VCs have funded startups these days, we've kind of been forced into a model where it's get something out the door as fast as you can. And even if there's not a ton of innovation in it, when everything you see is in the terms of revenue and, you know, getting users on board and things like that, you end up in many cases not really being too innovative, right? And I know that I'm generalizing a little there. But with Cycle, one of the things that we tried to do is we figured, okay, if we're going to spend the time building Cycle, we wanted to make sure that we have the actual ability to innovate, right? And so this is where we went back. And as we were looking at Docker and Kubernetes and some of these other companies in the space, we were like, all right, if we want to build something innovative, we need to do it where we are building it from the ground up ourselves, right? Because there's so much engineering that happens these days where people are kind of puzzle piecing things together. But I think there's a certain point where if you keep puzzle piecing things together, that you end up with a product or a service that is, you just end up with too much complexity within those different layers, right? And so with Cycle, we made the decision of, okay, if we want to innovate, we have to build this from the ground up, and we're going to spend more time doing it right and be opinionated about what we are doing, right? There's, I think, a lot of projects these days where organizations and developers try to solve every single use case. And within taking that approach, you end up, I don't know, it's the whole cliche of if you try to sell to everyone, you're selling to no one, right?
Yeah.
And so with Cycle, we were like, okay, we want to be opinionated enough that we're making people's lives easier, but also opinionated enough in our own development that we can innovate quickly. I guess is really what it all comes down to, but innovate quickly in a way that we are not just piecing different puzzle pieces and things like that together. So from a founder perspective, getting to the question that you had asked, this is kind of going full circle now. If we go back to the conversations about the chat rooms on Battle.net. So I was probably about 13 or 14 at the time. And there was a guy named Alex. He went by the username of Shadow, right? This was back when like people were just really starting to get into MySQL and building like PHP applications and things, right? This developer, Alex, who I'd met in this chat room, he was building a CMS, but using a flat file system to do it. So it had no database. Technically, it was still a database, but it wasn't like MySQL or anything. It was literally just writing text files and things for user accounts and things like that. And it sounds weird to talk about that now as being, you know, something super exciting, but back as a 13, 14-year-old that was learning, kind of figuring out what path I wanted to take as a developer, it was really interesting to have someone step out and say, well, I'm going to just do it this own way. And question why? Didn't matter why. He just wanted to do new things, right? And I think that it was kind of right around that moment that I started to experiment with like, okay, maybe there is value in trying new ways to do things. I mean, sure, sometimes those will fail, but it was, I think at that time, that was a pretty big influence on who I became as a developer, because I had an extreme amount of respect for this guy because he was just building really complex things on his own. And, you know, just some part of me wanted to be that as well.
Hmm.
Actually, coincidentally, last year, he found me on LinkedIn and we connected for the first time in like 15 years. We've you know, since had conversations, but it's just...
How funny.
Yeah.
So one thing, again, going back to my own experiences as a founder is like, you are what you do, really. We focus on explanation, analysis of at scale, development, deployment, and management for software engineers and developers. Pretty basic. And then we try to live up to that in our stories and the work that we do. And when I think of what you do, we've had a few conversations. I can get that complexity that you're talking about because what you've built is no DevOps, really. Really, you're trying to minimize the DevOps roles. There's no Kubernetes involved, really. It's all bare metal, right?
Yeah. So Cycle was built with the idea of running on mainly bare metal. Today, you can also extend Cycle to virtual machines and things.
Sure.
But yeah, it was that approach. Like most of my life before building Cycle was in bare metal. And so I think it was kind of that natural kind of stepping stone for me. And to the point that you just made, the general idea was, how can we eliminate a lot of the DevOps needs, but use just any commodity infrastructure to do it? right? Like you shouldn't have to be on a specific cloud provider that has features A, B, and C to be able to use Cycle. So it was very simple. Like as long as you have a server that's connected to the internet, that should be all you need, right?
So you've built a TCP protocol as well.
Yes, actually, yes.
So you didn't put the pieces together like you say a lot of startups you see doing, which it makes it a little bit more complex, I think, for them, you're saying, to develop, because now you're building in all these layers so these puzzle pieces fit together. Who do you look for then in terms of people to work with? And I'm thinking of it in terms of the engineering term first, but then I'd like to get into the how a technical founder thinks about positioning and pricing. But maybe you could talk to me about who you started looking for engineers and who is able to grasp these kinds of concepts.
Yeah. So the general idea was that if we build everything within Cycle the same way, using the same stack, using the custom TCP protocol that we had built, the general idea was that everything could have native communication between each other. Because one of the common issues that you have when you're building those puzzle pieces is you have that translation layer that has to happen, right? If you're going from one service to another service, at some point you have to translate between those two things. And there's complexity that can happen in that process. Or there's bugs because, like, suppose one of those puzzle pieces needs replaced later. How many things is that going to break? Maybe a call that you're using got deprecated. So with engineers, the way that we built this stack of having all of the Cycle services built the exact same way, using the exact same languages, all built on house, it's really nice because as we go out and look for developers, at least for our back end and our middle stack, we really just need good Golang developers, right? Because everything is built in Golang and all of the TCP protocol that we had implemented was on top of regular network calls and things like that. It allows us to have that extreme flexibility in terms of we don't have much legacy code, we don't have to deprecate much. It allows us to just keep moving really quickly. But at the same time, instead of having to go out and find engineers that it's like, okay, we need you to know this technology, this technology, this technology. You have to learn, you know, Prometheus and all these Kubernetes things or all these just weird different technologies, gRPC and all this stuff. It's really nice to be able to say, hey, we need people who are really good at Golang and have like good foundational knowledge of networking and infrastructure. While it required more time to build, it allows us to move a lot faster. I've heard this quote is misattributed, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But it was told to me one time. It was an Abraham Lincoln quote. And it was, if I have 8 hours to cut down a tree, I'll spend 7 hours sharpening my axe, right? And that was the Cycle approach. We'll really define and get opinionated about our approach so that way we can keep moving really fast as time goes on. And that's the same thing with the engineers that we're able to bring on board. Once they understand those fundamentals of how we built everything, they can just start running in terms of getting up to speed very quickly.
So when you're changing messaging from like going from container orchestration to be a platform of platforms, what do you say to your engineering team? Does it really matter to them at all? Really, at that point, you're just thinking about the positioning of the company, and you can then talk about that with other people on your team.
With changing our messaging, it really hasn't changed much of our development roadmap or our timeline or processes around that. Most of it has been around the fact that we've gotten into a number of really good conversations recently with companies that have said, oh, I've tried Heroku, or oh, I've tried some other platform as a service. But the problem that I had with those is the on-ramp was really easy. It was very easy to get started. But the problem that I keep encountering with these PaaS offerings is that they have a low ceiling, that there's a certain point where I'm almost forced to go find a new way of hosting and running my application. And so throughout these conversations with customers, it was, hey, with Cycle, I really like that ceiling is much higher. I can choose the provider I want to use. I can choose the infrastructure I want. If I want to have a small virtual machine, great. If I want to run a rack of bare metal servers, I can do that as well. With being the platform for building platforms, our goal is to be opinionated enough to make it easy, but still flexible enough that ceiling is still sky high. And so by changing that messaging to saying, you know, the low ops platform for building platforms, we've actually had a significant uptick in conversions recently from marketing funnels. I think the messages are just resonating because it immediately shows people who are looking for that sort of offering that we align with them, right? Like that, you know, if you're trying to build something of substance, the Cycle is a great place for you to build that.
So the tagline is low ops.
Yeah, the low ops platform for building platforms.
When you're a technical founder, right, is different than myself, who I'm a journalist, right? I have a different expertise that comes into it. You bring in your technical expertise. I mean, as a first-time founder, I had to learn how to manage people, and I had to learn, you know, a lot about how to like think about pricing and things like product fit. And like, I think you're talking about with like kind of changing your marketing message a little bit. How have you approached things like learning pricing and, you know, and talking to customers and things that when you're younger, you're not really thinking about because you're spending a lot of time just learning to code?
It's difficult. I think one of the hardest things about being a founder is, you know, you can be a good developer, but that doesn't mean that you're good at pricing strategy, right? You can be, you know, a good developer and not good at marketing or things like that. There's so many more people in the world that are so much more articulate than I am. I always seem to have an issue expressing things in a very clean way. But in terms of pricing strategy, I think it's just one of those things that like you just have to be open to constantly trying new things until you start finding something that works. We've recently actually changed our pricing model. We released it, I think, 2 weeks ago, something like that. The previous model worked well for the company, and it worked well because it was a model that scaled with usage directly, right? But the problem with the previous model is that there's two things. Number one, it was hard to explain. And number two, it almost discouraged people from scaling, right? And if our entire concept is, you know, the platform for building platforms, we definitely shouldn't be discouraging people from growing. In terms of pricing, we were noodling on it for a month or so. Like, how can we simplify this pricing model, still do what we need to do, still, you know, obviously cover costs, but position things in a way that is much more friendly towards potential customers. And I wish we had made this change earlier, but again, to your point, everyone has different strengths and weaknesses. So I think in terms of pricing strategy and things like that, you just have to get it out there, test it, see if it works. And if it doesn't, you know, try a different approach until you find something that works really well.
That's pretty cool. So you're mostly on bare metal. It's interesting you talk about Prometheus and gRPC and things like that. Those sound like puzzle pieces to me.
They are.
I guess just my final question for you is, how do you like it? How do you like being a founder? Like, what would you say to people who are starting this journey themselves? Let's start with that. And then maybe the next question is, what would you ask the people who've been in technical founders before who have more experience than you?
To the first question, how do I like it? I would say I like it probably 80% of the time. I've been at this for about six and a half years now. The pros are that, you know, you can really set out on solving some big problems. And I love solving problems. The con is that the stress never ends. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the stress is, it's something that I think a lot of founders don't want to publicly talk about stress, just because like it's a sign of weakness or whatever it is. I think that's part of it. And then the other part is I've lost a number of good friends over the years, you know, just as the company grows, the needs of the company change. I'm sure it's something that, you know, that you've gone through as well, that, you know, there was people that were, you know, great people, but they just didn't make sense for the company anymore or whatever the reason was. And it's always unfortunate to lose friends because of things like that. No one likes being fired, right? No one likes having to have difficult conversations when something's not going well. That's the most difficult part. But obviously, you know, seven years in and I'm still doing it, I still enjoy most of it, right?
Yeah, 80% is pretty good.
80%, yeah, it's still pretty good. So your second question of what questions would I ask other founders who have more experience? I think the most challenging thing for me today are the items around proper team building. And actually, relative to my response to the first question, is proper team building, and you're making sure that everyone is incentivized, but also balancing that with the changing requirements of a company. It can be demotivating to a team to have to change up that team from time to time as the company's demand changes. But at the same time, you don't want to demotivate people who are still on that team. So I think that's the hard part, is like most of the questions I would have would come down to to team building. I mean, it sounds weird, but I read a post one time. It was a few months ago. I don't remember where I read it. I think it was either Reddit or LinkedIn, but it was something along the lines of 4 years. It said, you know, 4 years to really get a company going, because after those 4 years, most people who were there that started it with you are not going to be there anymore, or something along the lines of that. A really good hire who's really incentivized, you can expect to be around for about 4 years. After that, they're going to be on to do something else, right? I kind of get it. People always want to have new experiences. They always want to try new things, et cetera, et cetera. But when your goal is to build a company over a decade and not just over a couple of years, that four-year window really hurts. And it's something that we keep seeing and seeing and seeing and seeing, is that even great people, they'll come to the company, you know, they'll enjoy it for a few years, and then they'll be on to something else. And that's always a challenge.
Jake, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me. I appreciate your candidness. For anyone who is unfamiliar with Cycle, they really have a unique take. And their whole bare metal story is an interesting one. And so I would urge people who are curious about Jake's perspectives on bare metal to reach out to him, because he's got a really interesting take on it and like how you think about it in comparison to fully virtualized in container platforms such as Kubernetes. And the differences there and the complexities that come with Kubernetes is something that Jake really can speak to. So Jake, thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to talking soon.
Thanks, Alex. It was a blast.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's one of the best ways you can help us grow this community, and we really appreciate your feedback. You can find the full video version of this episode on YouTube. Search for The New Stack, and don't forget to subscribe so you never miss any new videos. Thanks for joining us, and see you soon.